Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Well, hello, Judy, and hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks the title of today's episode.
Collaborative Reproduction, an interview with Leslie Schreiber and Angela Paoli.
And folks, this is a topic we have not touched on before in our episodes, and I think we both just found it really fascinating. Mm-hmm. We've already done the interview. Leslie Schreiber is an attorney who specializes in all of the legal issues involved in collaborative reproduction, and Angela Paoli is a social worker who handles a lot of the work involved, the mental health side of that, and just fascinating and informative stuff. So if you were drawn to this episode by the title, I think you're going to get some very good information.
So especially if you're dealing with these issues of infertility, reproduction, surrogacy, all the stuff that's involved when one has to go through.
Not to throw in a tiny spoiler, but one thing Leslie said that was fascinating to me, she said 1 in 8 people will be diagnosed as infertile, which is an astonishingly high number. I didn't realize. I mean, I know I see it a lot.
It was that high either.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was that high. So do hang on for that. But before we go to our interview, we've got all kinds of exciting stuff to talk about here.
Yes, we do.
So what should we talk about first? You decide. Well, let's talk about the books that we're promoting, and then we can talk about our sponsor. How's that?
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay. So, let's see, we have our books that started everything.
Yes.
We're plugging Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. That was Bruce's first book in this genre. And then the one that came out not too long ago, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
Yes, and those two books cover a lot of my favorite topics, of course. That's why I wrote them. And I will simply say, if you're looking to improve your relationship, if you're looking to wonder, gee, what went wrong in our relationship, you will find those books very informative. Now, there are two much shorter booklets that I have since written.
The bonus books.
The bonus books.
Okay, so we have 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
Yes, indeed. And that's the 7 words of that our podcast is named after. Be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And this one is not only available to purchase, but you don't even have to purchase it. You want to tell folks how we get this for free?
Exactly. You won't get the paperback for free. So if you like the looks of this very nice book, and it's got, you know, it's got color pictures in it, and or actually
well, the
in
paperback
has black and white pictures, but anyway, if you like the paperback, go to Amazon and buy it. If you want to get an audiobook, go to Amazon and buy it. But as you say, if you want a PDF of that book, then all you have to do is sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter, which you can do right from our website, ctn7.com. You'll see that up above our heads if you're watching this. And if you're just hearing it, it's ctn7. That's the number 7. ctn7.com. Couples Therapy in 7. Get it? ctn7.com. When you go there, you'll see a magic box appears that's saying, click here to sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter. So do that, and you will receive an email that will give you access to a PDF of that wonderful book. I think it's a wonderful book, 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life. It's, you know, it's not merely, it's not like a how-to, it's inspirational. And really all
that's
of my books, I think inspirational is a way of describing it. And then there's
another bonus booklet. My husband complains about my cleaning. What do I do? Hint, it's not about cleaning.
Exactly. It's about, of course, relationships.
Relationships. Yeah. It all comes down to relationships.
It does. And that's a book. Boy, that's a pretty specific topic. That book, of course, I created because so many people were searching for, they ended up on my website in a particular blog post that talks about that. I say, wow, hundreds of people are wrestling with that. And so I wrote a book for them. And if that's one of them, if that's one of you, feel free to go to Amazon and get a hold of it. Now, Let's, before we go to our word from our sponsor, let's also put in a word for our wonderful
merch.
We got merch for ctn7.com.
Yes, we do. We've got beautiful mugs.
That's what we're holding for those of you who aren't able to see this.
T-shirts.
We got tote bags.
All kinds of beautiful
things. Yeah, I brought up the tote bag again. Haven't brought it down since last week, did I? Here's the tote bag for those of you seeing this.
Our beautiful logo on one side and our motto, be kind, don't panic, and have faith on the other side.
And that's a quality tote bag.
It is, and it's lightweight. It folds up easily. Can carry all kinds of good stuff in
there. Yeah, we use it all
like
the time.
All your books.
And so now we will have a word from our sponsor. So, who is our sponsor, Judy? You can tell folks.
Well, if you were tuned into our previous episode on erotica and toys and whatnot, you will notice that our new sponsor is The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
And Laria Zilber is, that is someone we know, actually. It's a pseudonym of someone we know.
Mm-hmm.
And she is sponsoring this. And we're involved in it particularly because, in fact, she asked Judy to do the audiobook of this, and it is, which isn't available quite yet.
Not
You're in
yet.
The process
right
of
now
recording
it's
that.
Just available on paperback or Kindle.
Yes, it's available from Amazon. And Judy, you want to tell folks like what it's a erotic tales from the Bible. You want to
right.
expand
it's,
on that
it's
a bit?
Right. Well, it's an anthology, I guess. It's got 10 short stories of, I guess, stories based on tales from the Bible, like the title says, Abraham and Sarah, Adam and Eve, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, Joseph and, you know. His exploits, David, Jonathan, and Michal. Mm-hmm. It's got all of your favorite biblical characters.
It does. And I will mention one of the things I just found. How can I say? I found the book very exciting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interpret that the way you will. It is erotica. It is meant
erotica.
To be exciting.
Yes.
And it is. It's
yes,
really
it's
well
sexually
written.
Explicit.
It is sexually explicit. So if you're not into that, then you wouldn't want to buy that book. But if you enjoy that, it's not only arousing in that way.
That's right.
It's also, I really appreciate it because it is Jewishly knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
It is based not only in the biblical text, but it's also based in Midrash.
Right.
For those of you who know what Midrash is. So it is a very knowledgeable take on these stories.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's, in addition to Adam and Eve, before that, there's Lilith and Adam.
Right.
Those
and
of you
who
are familiar.
And if you don't know the story of Lilith.
Yeah.
Read the book.
Read the book and you'll
tell
learn
you
about
all
that.
About it.
Which Laria did not, she didn't make up that character.
No,
she, in fact,
no,
she
no.
didn't really make up any of the characters.
No, it's all in the Bible or like you said, Midrash, which
Midrash.
Is kind of scholarly interpretation of what happened. You know, it's reading between the lines
yes.
of the Bible.
And as I have taken to saying, what Laria did was she fleshed out those stories.
There you go.
Ho, 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 ho.
Ho, ho.
So
why don't we get on with our wonderful interview today?
Get on with the interview, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guests today are Leslie Schreiber and Angela Paoli. Leslie Schreiber has been an attorney in private practice since 1996. It was Leslie's own quest to become a parent that drew her to helping others who are navigating their way through the complexities of reproductive law. Leslie parlayed her lived experience with infertility into similar successes for the growing number of people involved with collaborative and assisted reproduction. She understood that her legal expertise, combined with her firsthand knowledge of collaborative reproduction, could be of a significant benefit to others. Angela Paoli is a clinical social worker with 26 years of experience in the mental health field, including work in the areas of substance abuse and incarcerated populations. Angela provides psychoeducational evaluations to the Vermont Surrogacy Network and has become the go-to mental health professional in Vermont to work with people involved in collaborative reproduction. Leslie and Angela, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. We always like to start with our guests, and we're going to do this with you too. And either one of you can go first, but we just want to know, how did you get into the work that you do? You know, what's your journey that got you here?
Angela, if it's okay, I started as a criminal appellate attorney,
in Florida, and I worked for the government for many years and had primarily been an appellate attorney. And because of my own quest to become a parent, I found myself deep down the rabbit hole of fertility clinics and OBGYNs. And I decided my path at that time was to be a single parent. And I have two beautiful children who, with the help of assisted reproduction, came to be, and they are teenagers now. And I parlayed that experience and transitioned from being an appellate attorney into the field of reproductive law, which at the time, there may have been 50 attorneys around the world, if that, doing the work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the law has had to keep up with the science. And yeah. We always say that in the legal arena. So we're lucky in that we get to work side by side in different ways with wonderful medical professionals.
Oh, yeah, Angela, how about your pathway to what you do?
Well, my pathway actually started with adoption work. It was at least 15 plus years ago that I was trained by an agency to do adoptions in Northern Vermont. And through that, I worked with various family practice lawyers. There just wasn't the volume of adoption cases here. So when that agency kind of pulled out of Northern Vermont, I started working with this lawyer doing adoptions, private adoptions through him. And then I got a call from a lawyer in New Jersey asking me to do a home visit for a gestational carrier, which was all new to me, but I was explained that being a gestational carrier was legal in Vermont and not in a lot of other states. And now we're talking 10 years ago at least. And so I did, my first one and really enjoyed it, meeting these women that were going to carry children for other couples. And so the lawyer that I had been doing adoption work with had decided to try to, start a reproductive medicine practice. So he started Vermont Surrogacy Network, and it has grown so much. It is now at least 35% of my work. Mm. When it used to be a little here, a little there, and now, I mean, weekly, at least every week, I'm doing some sort of reproductive medicine, mental health work.
Mm. Wow.
So, Leslie, could you tell us what are some of the legal issues that couples face when they decide to go this route?
Well, we're talking a very large umbrella of different types of needs that patients have. Mm. For example, a patient may need an egg donor or a sperm donor. A patient may be able to produce their own viable gametes. However, they can't successfully carry a child. So in that route, they would need a gestational carrier. Or alternatively, maybe they're an alternative intended parent, meaning they may be a single parent, or they may be a same-sex couple. So because of those various branches, there are a variety of needs. I would say, in general, my work comes to me after those patients have been what we call medically cleared, and they need a physical medical clearance that they're free of various infectious diseases. Plus, they go through body work checkups.
You're talking now about the gestational carrier.
I'm talking about all of them, again, just in general, really depending on the needs, but they still are going to go to their reproductive endocrinologist to make sure there are no major issues. Okay. Really doesn't depend at that point on, you know, what avenue they're or approach they're taking.
So that would be true even of someone like of someone who's being an egg donor, you know, exactly. Hoping that.
So the egg donors and the sperm donors go through their medical analysis, plus their gametes are tested for a period of 6 months to determine whether or not those gametes carry any infectious disease. That process is regulated by the FDA. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few areas where the federal government does have regulation over the arena of reproduction and infertility. The rest, everything else is left up to the states. Each state can mandate their own rules regarding donations and gestational carriers in that regard. Those patients will also undergo what Angela does, which is called a psychoeducational consult. So they go through the mental health side as well. If those patients are given a clearance medically and psychologically, then they come to me. And at that point, I start the contracting process. And at that point, I'm hopeful that a lot of the big red flag issues are dealt with. Issues of genetics, for example, in the case of donation, we always talk about the severance of any legal ownership issues that may arise between the person providing the aid, whether it's donation or carrying a child. Those legal ties need to be cut off so that they can then be transferred to the intended parent. Mm. So the legal contract takes care of all of that. And I always say that the legal contracting process really flushes out the hot spots that the previous medical team may not have been able to touch on, because it's only then that the clients really see, oh, that's what they mean by, you know, who's getting the embryos in case of divorce. Oh, that's what they mean, that I have no right to visit the child. Mm-hmm. In the case of surrogacy, the hot topics are always termination of pregnancy, who gets to make the choices around how those children will be carried, and what happens in that 9-month process. That's a long time for intended parents to cross their fingers and hope that everything goes smoothly. So I think the one piece of advice I always tell my clients at the beginning is this is always assume there's going to be bumps along the way, and you have to take a leap of faith, because you're leaving so much up to issues that are out of your control.
Yeah.
Angela, you can jump in there.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get to Angela to ask you, what are some of the, you know, Leslie addressed the legal, what are the psychological implications for couples and or a surrogate, you know, donors, carriers, parents to be, all parties involved?
Well, I'll focus on couples because there are so many just with couples. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the case of an intended parent who is going to either use a surrogate or use an egg donor or a sperm donor, we talk about a lot of how they got to this point, mm-hmm. and what their process has been. How they've come to terms with needing collaborative reproduction assistance. And of course, as a social worker, I always make sure that they have good coping tools for that.
I'll note in that regard, you know, as our viewers and listeners know, I'm a couples therapist, and you know, that's what this is about, of course. And you know that, Angela, I should tell our viewers and listeners, I mean, it's interesting how Angela came to be part of this particular podcast, because we are colleagues in the same group. Yeah. But that's not how it happened. It actually happened through Leslie, who works with Angela, and then come to discover, you know, Angela saying, wait a minute, I'm being interviewed on your podcast. How'd that happen? You know, because we didn't even know, even though we're colleagues.
I know.
Anyway, yeah. You know, the couples therapy part that I get to see is in that before they get to that. You know what I mean? I'm seeing the effect of infertility on the couple, which of course affects couples lots of different ways. You know, feel free to address that as well. But then by the time you're talking to them about their use of collaborative reproduction, they've been through a whole lot, I would imagine.
Absolutely. They've been through a lot. And I am not a couples counselor, so I don't do couples work per se. I give that to you, Bruce, usually. But we do really focus on how they work together and if they have, made peace with where they're at in this process. And then when you are an intended parent using a gestational carrier, this is quite lengthy. I spend generally at least 3 hours with the intended parents and the gestational carrier. And we go over everything. And like Leslie said, termination is always a very, emotional discussion. But it's imperative that both couples, the gestational carrier and her partner, and the intended parent and their partner, that they all agree that if something is not right, and what would that something be? In order to make the decision of termination. There's very, very slight possibilities of multiples, and then selective reduction decisions come in. We talk about all of those so that by the time it gets to Leslie, hopefully everyone is on the same page. But agencies do a really good job, even before that gets to me, of matching people that have like beliefs, because you get some couples that would never terminate, and then you get some that would, that just do not have the resources. Some of our couples tend to be older, and they have to take that into consideration as well. So there's so many different variables that go into that, but that, like Leslie said, is definitely a point of discussion that we always have.
Who does make that call?
That's really a legal issue, and the law of the land, meaning the federal law, is that the woman carrying the child, in this case it would be the gestational carrier, has the right to make all choices related to the pregnancy she is carrying. Mm. However, if you think of the complexity of what happens during a pregnancy, you have issues that may involve the health of the mother. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. The health of the gestational carrier that may have no impact upon the fetus. So the gestational carrier is then perhaps dealing with a personal health issue, which may indirectly impact the fetus. So depending on the state that I'm representing the clients in, and I'm only allowed, I represent clients in 3 states because I'm licensed in those 3 states. Depending on the law in that particular state, I will then work my contract language in such a way that reflects the clients, the party's wishes. In this case, only my clients, because the other party would have their own independent attorney. Oftentimes, for example, I have provisions, we all have provisions in our contracts dealing with life support. What happens if a pregnant woman finds herself in need of being put on life support?
Oh my, wow.
Then what happens? So all of, we have issues related, we have clauses related to the termination of pregnancy, and we break that down. At what point in time do you get to terminate? Well, now, because of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade and everything was kicked back to the states, it has everybody in my field scrambling to figure out, how do we protect both sides? How do we prevent ourselves from being sued? You know, thankfully we are in a very, in Vermont here, we are in a very reproductive friendly state that respects the reproductive autonomy of the persons involved in reproduction. That would be mainly the person carrying the child. And that's been codified in the Vermont Constitution. Unlike most states where they are limiting the time that one is able to make a choice to terminate a pregnancy, even if somebody's life is at risk. So now I have to add clauses in the contract that say, in the case that termination of pregnancy is required, the parties agree that the gestational carrier will be allowed to leave that particular state and travel across state lines to get to a safe haven. Wow. And the intended parents will pay for that.
Mm. Wow.
Wow.
So I probably veered off track there, but
I mean, you know, these are things that unless you're going through it, you don't think about. And even if you are going through it, that's why we have folks like you to think about those things.
Yeah.
Or know those things.
Yeah. So. I can imagine all sorts of things which undoubtedly come up, things as simple as, say, the gestational carrier changing her mind, you know, somewhere early on in the pregnancy saying, oh, well, I really don't want to go through this. Obviously, the hope is that people have been screened to such an extent that that's very unlikely. But I would imagine that that happens on occasion.
I would say, you know, we always hear because of the news, the bad stories.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's about 0.001% of all of our experiences. I have been doing this since 2010, and not once have I ever had a donor come back to lay claim to the intended parents that they donated to. I have never once had a negative gestational carrier experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the contracting process. They understand that they are all giving up their legal and moral rights to any attachment or any attachment to this child. I would say that in general, there are issues now with respect to what used to be purely anonymous egg and sperm donation.
Yeah, thank you.
Now we have the lovely internet and good search engines. The standard in the field is there is no anonymity. Mm-hmm. And they've actually, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine has actually changed the terminology to non-identified donation. So the lexicon has changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they can't guarantee anonymity. Kid grows up and searches the database. And of course, that's getting easier and easier. Yeah.
Well, even the donors can find the intended parents.
Right.
You know, and vice versa. I've had gestational carriers using where the intended parents have used a donor, and they've done a couple of searches and they found these collaborative partners.
Wow. Yeah.
Of course, I'm obviously not allowed to say anything, but
sure. Now something that I'm guessing does come up, and I'm only saying this because of my own experience working with couples, which is, what happens when the, let's say it's a married couple that are arranging for this and they break up in the middle of it? I've actually seen that happen. So I'm guessing you've run into that. What happens then?
From a legal perspective?
Legal, and Angela, feel free to weigh in as well if you get involved.
Honestly, I have never seen that. I'm sure it happens later and then it must be a legal issue. But you know, I'm so involved in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I have to ask sometimes, what happened to so-and-so? Because sometimes I don't even get to hear the ending. So Leslie, I don't know if you've ever had a case like that.
I have. Yeah. And I've actually given a seminar on I gave a seminar, a webinar to the Inns of Court called Embryo Disposition, What Happens in Case of Divorce and Separation. Usually, what happens is if a couple, whether married or not married, goes to a fertility clinic and they have to create embryos before those embryos are transferred into, let's say, a gestational carrier or into the intended mother, and they're not using a gestational carrier. The bottom line is an embryo has to be created. So you have a gamete and a sperm provided by each of those people. The medical team does what they need to do to prepare that embryo. And let's say they transfer two embryos to the intended parent, mother. What happens to the other 10 that were prepared? Well, those are generally cryopreserved. And at the, I see a lot of issues come up where there's a disconnect between what's called the informed consent documents that are provided by the fertility clinic, and then, and which I am not privy to unless I ask for it, because those were prepared could be a year before they even come to me. So generally at that point, they don't have legal counsel. So they don't really understand that there's a maybe a difference between disposing of the embryo. So what happens if you get pregnant from those two embryos and there you've got 10 frozen? You've got to pay for those 10. Every year you're going to get a bill between $500 and $1,000 to keep maintaining those embryos. Well, at a certain point, you need to make a choice. And that is a very difficult choice, because you've kind of put it away emotionally for a bit. And then when you get the bill, you realize, wow, I have much to think about here. What do I want to do? Do I want to scientifically donate them to science? Do I want to formally dispose of them, or do I want to continue with the cryopreservation process? That becomes, I think, very emotionally tricky. And those are things that are decided, you know, in advance of legal contracting. But usually I like to look at those documents. I almost require it, because I want to make sure my contract is in sync with their intentions on those informed consents. And that informed consent, if that couple then splits up, what do you do with the remaining 10? Well, this is where you do see a lot of case law.
Okay, I've read about that one, that sort of situation.
These cases go to court a lot because of couples who are fighting. Ultimately, the court is going to look at whatever agreements have been signed. Depending on the jurisdiction, they will look at maybe... Generally, a court will take a balancing act. What are the needs of the person who wants to use the embryo to create a family versus the person who is saying no? Generally, it's the female who wants to use the embryos to get pregnant after they've split up. Maybe she's a cancer survivor. In those cases, because her chances of getting pregnant and having healthy embryo, healthy eggs at that point after chemo are almost nil. So maybe a court will let her use that embryo to create a child. Versus the concept call where many courts have relied on, which is the idea that you can't force somebody to be a parent. Just because you want to get pregnant and have a family, you can't force your ex-spouse to parent that child. So that's where it gets really contentious and complicated.
Because, well, like, what would, let's say in that situation, a woman wants to keep the embryo, man doesn't, what are his legal obligations as a father, parent, to support the kid? Is that, you know, basically what?
Well, that's a very viable question, and that is the question. Can you sever those ties statutorily? What does the state law say? So depending on the state, again, and the rules regarding what it parental rights in that state? How does their statute define being a father? Mm. You know, in other words, this is where the law needs to keep up with the science, because the science and technology moves so fast. And
yeah, and of course, from a couples therapy point of view, not only, of course, the law needs to keep up, but in terms of the psychological and moral implications, uh-huh. You know, I'm thinking like a man, because I am one.
Yes.
The moral and psychological implications of, okay, so I've participated in creating an embryo that is now going to become a child. And I don't know what to do, you know, even if I'm thinking, well, it's happening against my will, but I've still participated in this creation, much as in, you know, the traditional way of doing that is a one night stand. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I wasn't intending to create a baby, but by golly, there is one. And yeah. Now I have to own up to that. And it's got to be tricky to deal with in these circumstances.
I think with good, therapists, frankly, and good conversation, good, healthy relationship, good communication between the parties. I'm a true believer these things should and can be kept out of court. You don't want a third party judge who knows nothing about your business, mm-hmm. making these very personal decisions. Yeah. I am a lawyer, but I try to avoid litigation at all costs. So, you know, this is where working with people like you guys comes in to, let's see if we can resolve this amicably.
I'm also curious, this is coming from a different perspective. I'm also curious, are there situations where the gestational carrier does remain involved in the child's life, you know, by agreement with the parents?
We do have a clause in the contract called future contact. Mm-hmm. And that also is the same in ova donation contracts, and sperm donation will mm-hmm. have a clause. So what happens after the baby's born? And that depends on the parties. I would say probably 100% of my gestational carrier cases, the parties are always on very friendly terms. They like each other. They respect each other. And they're in each other's lives in the future. Yeah. Maybe an annual birthday card. Maybe they're Zooming with a kid. Mm-hmm. That degree of contact is what is negotiated in the contract.
Yeah.
I would say usually or always the intended parent really has more of a say-so in how it's handled, mm-hmm. because they are the parent.
Yeah.
They're the one that are making choices for this child up until that child reaches adulthood.
Yeah. And in that regard, it is very similar to adoption, I imagine, right? It's like very similar to adopting a child, that the parents are the ones who decide. But an open adoption is one in which they can allow, you know.
Well, now most adoptions are open. Going that route. In other words, the reproductive industry learned from the adoption industry in that secrets don't work.
Yes.
These children have a right to know their genealogy and where they came from, if they can access that information for their own mental health. You don't want to go through life with a huge question mark.
Yeah.
So I counsel my clients always to tell early, tell often,
yeah.
and don't hold secrets.
I worked with a family many, many years ago where what had happened was, there was a brother and a sister in their mid-teens, and the sister got pregnant from the brother, and she gave up that child for adoption. By the time I met the family, this was early in my practice back in the 90s. By the time I met the family, they were all trying to say, we don't want to think about this anymore. And of course that wasn't working terribly well, but I was always curious about, you know, that's the one situation where I would wonder, is that child better off knowing or not knowing? You know, those edge cases are interesting, but of course that's the vast, you know, that's a very unusual phenomenon. But I would always wonder about that.
Yeah, that is really unusual. I'm not sure I've ever seen that either, but, and like Leslie said, we did learn from adoption, which is where I started. And I counsel everybody involved you know, to consider openness and transparency with their children, with, you know, everyone support for support as well. And just like Leslie said, tell early, tell often. There's so much, so many resources now. There's so many books that you can read your children to help them understand. So many ways to make families now, and it's becoming more normalized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say that 95% of people that even come into this are planning to do it that way. But every once in a while, you get somebody who, for their own personal reasons, would rather not. And of course, you know, I try to give them the evidence that says secrets bring shame. You know, why was this not brought out? Was it something you were embarrassed about? You know, so that is big. And, you know, I also want to just add that ahead of time, these agencies do a very good, if you go through an agency, which I hope everybody does, sometimes people do not, but if you go through an agency, a lot of the matching process is done so that everyone is kind of thinking the same way, because I'm sure Leslie's worked with people like this. I know I have. Sometimes I get two sets of couples that don't want a relationship. They want it to be a business transaction. Mm-hmm. And that's not very often. Most people do this, and the gestational carrier and her partner want to create this experience for the intended parents. It's not anything that's genetically theirs. So they really want to make this their journey. And the levels of altruism with all of the players here is amazing. And it's something I learned, you know, by doing all these years. And I thought in the beginning it might be financially motivated. Generally, it's the financial piece is needed usually. But the things, I could tell you story after story of what people did with their compensation that is so noble and so amazing that it is an honor for me to work with the quality of human beings.
Yeah.
Could you share some of them?
So of what people have done with?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that surprised you.
One of my very first cases was Vermont is so small, it makes me a little uncomfortable. Like, oh, do I say?
Yeah, no,
this?
I get that. Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
But I'll just say in generalities, you know, people will use the money to help another child in need. Mm-hmm. I had one couple that a helping professional witnessed the death of a couple's child and then carried a child for them.
Oh my God.
Wow.
People step up. I mean, they step up, and it's really, like I said, it is a privilege. I realize, and ethically, even when I started, you know, I'm not a practicing Catholic, but it's very, I think it's always ingrained. But at first I was like, okay, where are ethics? You know, how are ethics here that you're choosing to do these things? And isn't it God's, what are you messing with God's plan? You know, but yeah. That is, doesn't even, it's not even a consideration in my mind anymore after having the pleasure to work with so many wonderful people that are here to help other people have families. And I know as a mother that it was the most wonderful thing for me. And that's what, like, gestational carriers have to have had their own children.
I wondered about that. That, of course, that makes sense from a couple of different standpoints, right? For one thing, you know, they are, they're at least in theory, capable of carrying a child. Right. Yeah. And also that would also speak to the idea that they won't be, you know, they won't become desperate to hang on to that child as much as if they didn't have kids themselves.
Well, sorry, go ahead, Angela.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, because it's not genetically theirs. Ooh, am I frozen?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't have you on camera.
Your sound is fine. Oh, there you go.
Okay. All right. Because it's not genetically theirs, and because they've already had their own children, they're set. They liked being pregnant. They had easy pregnancies, easy deliveries. They get to help someone, you know, realize their family. The attachment is really just, I want to love and nurture this pregnancy for the intended parents. And they have a relationship through the whole, from the beginning before it even starts to the end. And so nobody wants to keep that child that I've seen. Yeah. Have you ever seen that, Leslie?
Not in a gestational carrier relationship. That does happen in what they call a traditional surrogacy, where the person carrying the child is actually using her own gametes. The ASRM actually sort of very tactfully further defined that distinction. So a gestational carrier, we can't really use the word she's a surrogate anymore, because now they call a surrogate a person using her own gamete.
I was wondering what that distinction
was. Because a lot of lawyers will not do a traditional surrogacy, because they, by dint of the nature of the person carrying, it becomes emotionally complicated. And those are the ones, the cases that you hear about in the news that are written, where, oh, she decides at the last minute, I'm not giving up this baby.
And then
it becomes complicated, because it is her genetics, but she has a contract where her legal rights have been severed. But again, it doesn't, you know, as long as when a potential client and patient is starting this journey, if they dot their I's and cross their T's in the right way, I can almost guarantee that there will not be problems that come to the fore after that child is born. Mm-hmm. You see problems when people don't want to use a lawyer, or they're very flippant about their relationships. Another area, which I love the terminology, I did not create it, it's called gamete friending. So where a single female, you know, in her 30s or 40s or 20s, has this best friend who's a guy. And
often a gay guy, actually.
A gay guy, a straight guy, just a guy with sperm. And she has asked him, and he has agreed to donate sperm to her. Well, why do I need a contract? He's my best friend. He's never going to come back. Well, this we call gamete friending, because it's those relationships that get very heated if those I's aren't dotted and those T's aren't crossed, because oftentimes the female will go into that relationship. He's just giving me his sperm and I don't want him involved in any way in the parenting process, but he has a completely different conception. Oh, I'm going to get to parent this child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe one day he'll even call me dad. And, that's why you need a contract, because during that process, you realize, okay, this is not a good match, because they are coming from two different points of view here. Mm-hmm. I had a case once where a similar situation where the young lady was wanting to use the donation of her best friend. He was a gay male, and I was explaining to her, and she said, yeah, he wants to be involved. And, you know, but I don't want the baby calling him dad, but he's going to come over, he'll take the kid for weekends and this and that. I said, no, you know, you can't be half a donor and half a parent. You either have to be a donor with no legal rights or a parent. Mm-hmm. And then his mother got involved, and who happened to be a real estate attorney and very much wanted that she had a grandparent relationship with this child. Sure.
Yeah.
So you know, I could go no further because, you know, for me, it was very cut and dry, and legally it's very cut and dry. So I frankly don't know what happened to these lovely people. But I ended up not doing the contracting process with them. And I'm hoping that, you know, whatever fertility clinic they were working with, because not all fertility clinics are the same. Each clinic has different standards of what they will allow and what they don't allow.
Yeah, I mean, I know personally of some folks, a lesbian couple, that asked a friend to be the donor, and he was involved until he passed away. He was involved in that child's life, but not as a parent. They, right. You know, they seem to have worked out that well, but I don't know if she called him dad or not. I don't know about that. You know, if the child did, but it seemed to work fine. I'm sure that, you know, and I don't know, this was many years ago. I'm not sure to what extent they had legal assistance with that or
right.
not.
Yeah. Well, I think more often than not, again, if the people are reasonable, it can be worked out. But when you have two disparate points of view, and you're already arguing before contract stage, yeah. it's not a good sign.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I do want to ask you, Leslie, we saw on your website, I think, that you had given a talk at a synagogue on kosher conceptions.
Yes.
And, you know, as our viewers and listeners know, we're Jewish. We're heavily involved in the Jewish world. You know that, Leslie, because that's partly how we know you. Yes. And I'm just curious, what are some of the, if you want to get into that, what are some of the particular, you know, Jewish wrinkles on all of this?
Yeah,
well, I'll just start by saying a very large non-Jewish and universal wrinkle is that 1 in 8 people are declared infertile. So the number is rising worldwide.
Yeah.
And it's been rising for a very long time. So, you know, each genre, each population, they have different health issues and different, depending on their religious views, et cetera. So with respect to Jewish issues, and I will say that was sort of mistitled because the conference morphed into Catholic points of view and, you know, other religions. We had various people at that conference.
And I do, I'll hasten to throw in for our listeners, there's no such thing as a Jewish view on anything. You know, right. the joke is, you know, 2 Jews, 3 opinions. So,
and, well, and that is truly the case. I think, you know, even under the Jewish so-called umbrella, you have various degrees of belief systems. And I would say even the more conservative groups of Jewish teachers, for example, you will have certain rabbis that would approve donation, preferably. I would always say that, you know, you might want to find a donor who genetically is, you can narrow down that they grew up Jewish, that the female is Jewish, because then you're passing down that genealogy and also the sort of Judy and Bruce, you probably have better language, but the theology of, you know, if the mother's Jewish, then you're
right,
Jewish.
The matrilineal descent.
Matrilineal, yes.
So, I understand that gets complicated when you're talking about gestational carrier, because the rabbis of the Talmud didn't, pardon the double entendre, conceive. They didn't conceive of the possibility that the gestational carrier would be other than the biological mother.
Well, true. That's, yes, 100%. So, you know, I think it depends. I think what I came away with from that conference was, it depends on the group you belong to and the rabbi.
Yeah.
You know, who you're getting advice from. But I would say, you know, there are groups and more conservative Jewish sections that deal specifically with infertility issues, and they have their go-to people. Mm-hmm. I worked well for a long time with a Jewish egg donor agency. Run by a woman named Judy Weiss. And she sold the agency or closed it, but she was around for 20 or 30 years just working with Jewish donors. Mm-hmm. So you know, I would say because the problems exist and they exist across populations in terms of being infertile, that, you know, what may have been a rule 20 years ago is certainly broken down and being, you know, people are being a little more flexible.
Yeah.
Because you still want to help people have family.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I didn't realize 1 in 8 that I don't know what I would have thought, but that just sounds large. That's a lot of people, as you're pointing
out. A lot of people. Yeah. Well, you know, part of it is age related and part of it is, you know, just we are being poisoned so much by the environment and chemicals that, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah.
It's not just women. I mean, the male infertility rate has gone up dramatically.
Yeah.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that some very alarming statistics on sperm counts.
Yeah.
They are like way down in the, you know, the next generation than what they were in their generation.
Well, not only are they down, but they're growing three tails and they're swimming improperly. And no, it's not a pretty picture.
Well,
it's one way to keep the population down.
It is. I mean,
it's true. Like every generation has different ways of controlling population, you know, war, famine, and, you know, this is reproduction.
And, you know, something else that is along that line is that the younger generation is choosing not to have children.
Right.
They're choosing not to have sex, which is sort of comparatively, that's really fascinating. And of course, and also choosing not to have children or choosing to wait much longer. And then discovering that.
Well, I mean, with the egg donor population, because I do a lot of psychoeducational screening on the egg donors, and these are young women. I believe the cutoff is 32 to use their eggs, and they are choosing, and they will say, you know, environmentally, politically, I am at this time thinking I'm not going to use my eggs. And I know some women want to have families, so that's why I'm choosing to donate my eggs. I hear that more and more.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is again another one of those things that just sort of warms my heart that people would do something so selfless, because now here again says the man to all the women, you guys would know this and I wouldn't, but seemed what I've heard is that egg donation process is not without stress, right? That involves a fair amount of medical stress.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
And certainly to carry, you know, a gestational carrier, my God, what an act of love to do something like that for someone else. It's just, it's really beautiful that people would do that.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other things that we should know that we might not have asked that you want to share with us?
One of the things that I wanted to put out there that I thought was interesting, that it, because of the political climate, it's become an issue, is that some of our same-sex couples that are, you know, using a sperm donor, if it's a lesbian couple using a sperm donor, a gay couple using an egg donor, are afraid of losing the rights to their child. So they're having to go through the legal process of adoption in their state. And Leslie, I know, because we talked before, has seen this and has even recommended it to be on the safe side, because we don't know if, you know, marriage among same-sex couples is going to, you know, be recognized.
Yeah, that's a, it's got to be terrifying for, you know, for folks in that situation. It's got to be terrifying, you know, the thought of losing your child because some, you know, some politicians decided that they didn't, you know, they didn't like your existence.
That's happening all over this country.
Right. I mean, and for, you know, in my position, I wouldn't even think of that, even though I've been an adoption social worker, I wouldn't even think of that, but legally it's something that has to be considered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, marriage. Thank you both. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I interrupt something?
No. I just wanted to add to that. You know, it depending on the state, for example, I recommended that to all of my same-sex clients to go through that extra measure of adopting the child for the one, for example, who may not have carried the child. Or was the donor to the child. It's a security blanket, even though the Supreme Court has recognized same-sex marriage. Considering what happened to Roe v. Wade, you don't want to be in a position down the line where the court overturns that ruling.
Right.
And that's the fear. But it's a security blanket. I would say most states don't require it. It's not required.
Yeah.
But it's something extra they can do.
Okay. Well, now I will say thank you both. This was illuminating, fascinating, and brought up all kinds of issues that I really never thought about. So,
and let us know. We'll put Leslie. We'll put your website on the notes for this episode. Angela, we'll put yours too, so people can get in touch with you. Any other websites you'd like to recommend folks go to?
Well, I would highly recommend the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, called ASRM.org. Mm-hmm. And that is the umbrella organization for all the medical professionals involved in this field. They have all the, legal professionals have the opportunity to join, psychologists, doctors, and they have a patient portal. So if you're going through any sort of collaborative reproduction, you just double click the patient portal and you can pull up a plethora of information.
Oh.
The other organization I would recommend is resolve.org, which is the national organization for people using alternative means like collaborative reproduction or adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Resolve, ASRM, and then just Google, there's lots of different support groups, etc.
Yeah.
And Vermont, like we said earlier, is small, and the two agencies that I work with that do cross their T's and dot their I's is Vermont Surrogacy Network and Northeastern Reproductive Medicine. They're both great organizations that do their homework to make sure that everything runs smoothly and everyone gets their needs met throughout this process.
Great. Well, we'll put that information in the notes for this episode so that folks, when they're looking at this, can click on it or at least do a Google search. Thank you so much for doing this. This is really, as Judy was saying, this has just been really
very
fascinating and enlightening. And I'm sure that our viewers and listeners will really, benefit from your knowledge and expertise. So thank you very much.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview and learned something. I know I learned a lot from Leslie and Angela. Boy, things that I never, as I said earlier, never even thought about.
Absolutely. And of course, as I so often tell folks, that's why you need lawyers.
Yeah.
To think of the stuff that, stuff can go wrong. And it can be really, if you've dealt with it beforehand, it's a lot easier.
Because, we remember back into, it was the 80s, 90s with Mary Beth Whitehead with that horrible that situation where the people hired a surrogate and she wanted the kid. This is before all the laws were in place.
Yeah.
So things you got to think about,
Yeah. So check out in the notes for this episode, we're mentioning the websites that Leslie and Angela mentioned, and mm-hmm. so you can check that out as well.
Right.
Well, we have a few items to promote on our own end. First of all, the books that got all this started.
Mm-hmm.
You can
you can find that actually also in the notes. It's not about communication, why everything you know about couples therapy is wrong, and reigniting a spark, why stable relationships lose intimacy, and how to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the booklet you can get by simply signing up for my newsletter, 7 words to jumpstart your love life. Sign up for my newsletter. You can do it right from our ctn7.com website, and you will see that. And then, of course, there's one more book that is recent. My husband complains about my cleaning. What do I do? Hint, it's not about cleaning.
It's not about cleaning.
Exactly. And now we want to put in one more word for the sponsor of our episode.
Right. The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
And if you go to the Amazon site and just search for Laria Zilber, that's Z-Y-L-B-E-R, mm-hmm. for those of you who are just hearing this. And you can also go to lariazilber.com. That's L-A-R-I-A-Z-Y-L-B-E-R, lariazilber.com. And you will find links there where you can get hold of that book, and mm-hmm. Currently available as a ebook or also as a paperback, soon to be available
on audio.
As an audiobook, where Judy's doing
it. And yours truly will be doing the narration.
Very beautifully. I'm serving as the recording engineer,
yes,
and I have to
are.
Tell you,
you're
she does a nice job.
And we also do want to put in another plug for the podcast. Now, Leslie approached us about doing this. So if you have ideas that you would like us to talk about on our podcast, we would certainly welcome them. Go to ctn7.com, our website, and let us know if you have any topics you would like to talk about, if you would like to be on the show to talk about those topics, or if you have questions that you would like us to address on the show. Please write to us. ctn7.com.
And we're especially looking for some more listener questions. So those of you who followed us for a while will know we often, with our interviewees, we will include a listener question, or just when we're doing it without a guest, we'll include a listener question. And we're always on the lookout for those. So any sort of problem you're having that you think might be interesting to our listeners for us to talk about, we invite you to do that right from ctn7.com. And so until next time,
remember, be kind.
Don't panic.
And have faith.